When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Hello, sweet one. Do you strive to be somebody? Do you feel unless you become somebody, you have failed in life? Are you driven to make your mark in life, to gain fame and fortune? If this sounds like you, then please know you're not alone. Although many authors and artists and politicians and actresses and so many other people from different walks of life in different professions have chosen their line of work for the love of their craft or for the benefit of others, there are many who have followed their path in search of validation from the masses and the need for their name and their image to be in the spotlight. Plato once said, "How strangely men are moved by the passion for winning a name and laying up undying glory for all time." He said this because he knew that no one wants to be invisible. Everyone wants to be remembered for something. It follows along with the survival of the fittest, where everyone wants to become a somebody, a person who, as Plato said, wins a name. And yet, is his strive to be a somebody a negative human ambition? Of course it can be, if you equate being a somebody with fleeting external measures of value, such as outward appearance, or wealth, or even position. None of these things reflect who you truly are, for none of these things are lasting. Their measurement of achieving the status of importance has not stood the scrutiny of time. Marilyn Monroe was without a doubt the most beautiful woman to grace the screen. And yet, I wonder, if she had lived to be in her 60s, would Hollywood still be casting her as a leading desirable woman? Or would she go from being a Hollywood somebody to a Hollywood nobody? Does a rich person go from being a somebody to a persona non grata if their partner married them for money? And then overnight, they lost it all. The strive to be a somebody can be a negative human ambition if you allow the need to be a somebody put you in a position where you believe you are above others, where your self-worth is more important than another. For if you do, you lose your true connection with others in ways that include but go far, far beyond the ability to empathize with others and make this a better world in which to live. The strive to be a somebody can be a negative human ambition if you take excessive pride in your achievements to the point of vanity. Vanity leaves little time for reflection on why somebody works hard for their achievements and fills that void with the need to win at all cost that golden ring way on top. The strive to be somebody can be a negative human ambition if you become like Narcissus from the Greek mythology, who noticed his reflection in the water and became so deeply in love with his image that he could not part from looking at it. And the strive to be a somebody can be a negative human ambition if it deprives you of privacy. The alone time you need to discover who you are and what your place is in this universe. I think this is one of the issues people have with Facebook or with any social media platform or recording device that is on constantly and aired to the public. It puts too much pressure on the ego to be something that it is not. I remember when meals could be enjoyed because they were nutritious, and although flawed in appearance, they were shared with a joy by a family that made a conscious decision to sit down together and enjoy the meal and the conversation. Now the meal must be recorded, and every inch of the meal, the plate, the setting, it must all be perfect. For to not uphold the standard means you are, in essence, substandard. Being a somebody to the point that it deprives you of privacy is what led to the death of Princess Di. The paparazzi hounded her to no end, and she was the envy of all with her grace and her beauty and her genuine love for others. Her face on magazines resulted in sell-out issues, and yet she was a fragile person as you or I or all of us are. We all need alone time to deal with emotional demons that plague our lives, out of the sight of others. This is probably why we've also heard of actors claiming that their stardom has led to destructive, downward spiraling of drugs and other harmful practices, because they felt the need to stay on top, even though they lost the reason why, and even lost who they are. Being in the public's eye 24/7 never allowed them the privacy they needed to try all the same fun and seemingly stupid things we all try when we think no one is watching. What is it that makes all of humankind believe that to be somebody, you have to achieve a name that is uttered from the lips of the masses and will span generations with no end in praise of some glorious act that you have committed? To think so would in essence make most of us a nobody, and that is a fallacy, and that is destructive. And so it naturally extends the question that if being a somebody can be harmful, is it not better to be the opposite and be a nobody? True that a nobody does not draw the attention nor the admiration of the masses, but it does allow you the privacy you need to discover or rediscover who you are. I remember when I was 6 years old, I would pretend to be a teacher, and living in an area with few people my age, I picked the only students I could find, the frogs in the nearby swamp. Each day, when I knew that my parents were tending to my brother, I would sneak out to the swamp and I would grab a bunch of bullfrogs and bring them back to my house. There, I would put them in a huge cardboard box that I decorated like an elementary school class, and I would simulate what I had learned in school, only with me being the teacher. And as silly as this all sounds, having this alone time to me to be a kid and to discover what my passions were was critically important to me being able to spread my wings and solidify my core understanding of self and what motivates me to continue on a journey that feeds my soul. Needless to say, years later, I did earn a master's in teaching, which is one of the degrees I am proud to have obtained. Many people, like poet Emily Dickinson, believe that being a nobody and living in anonymity is preferable to being a somebody and having your life thrown in the path of continual fame. Her strong belief in being a nobody was penned in her poem, "I Am Nobody, Who Are You?" And I'd like to read that to you now. I'm nobody. Who are you? Are you nobody too? Then there is a pair of us. Don't tell. They'd banish us, you know. How dreary to be somebody. How public like a frog to tell your name the livelong day to an admiring bog. And so now I ask you, should we all opt to be a nobody? Absolutely not. Although we should all strive to be a nobody at some level, we should never opt out of being a somebody. Remember that life is a balancing act, and the idea of balancing opposites is key to any happy and productive life. If one strove to only be a nobody, humble and withdrawn and utterly private, how could that person help others? How can that person help to make this a better world in which to live? It is vital to our happiness to be both a nobody and a somebody. And here's a secret that I've been waiting to tell you. Plato is right when he said how strangely people act in their pursuit to be a somebody. For what I have noticed is that people are unaware that they are born a somebody, and they will retain that title for all of their days and beyond. The Oxford Dictionary defines a somebody as a person of importance. Are you not important at the very basic level to your family, to your parents who brought you into this world? It is strange that people do not understand their own worth, their own value. They have, like English poet Edward Young once said, forgotten who they really are. The truly happy people in this world are those who have balanced between being a somebody with being a nobody. Those people who have a deep understanding that they are somebody, that they have a level of importance to themselves and to others, and that this understanding is so intrinsically sewn into their mental fabric that they do not need to seek out validation, for they know that they are somebody. They do not need the admiration from masses, people who will never truly understand how important they are, only how important the publicity makes them seem. All of us should recognize that we are somebody. We are born somebody, and we will die a somebody, and our name and our imprint on this world will carry forward in the people whose lives we have touched. Such as our family and those that we have helped along the way. Yet we need to know that although being born as somebody, we must strive to elevate that level. For this realization will drive our actions to accomplish great things for the betterment of ourselves and humankind. And at the same time, in order to achieve great things, we need time to reflect. We need time to be humble or invisible to others, so that we can better understand ourselves and our impact on the world through reflection. We must allow ourselves the time for self-reflection and personal growth without shutting out the rest of the world and the good that we can do in it. We need to have the time to discover who we are and to laugh and to play and to cry and to scream and to open up a world of emotions without the microscopic scrutiny of those who are not part of our genuine relationships. And so, my sweet one, I am somebody and nobody and happy. And I ask, who are you? And now, my sweet one, it is time for part three of The Pen and the Pendulum. In this story, we have learned that things can go from bad to worse. And then in the last part, we will find that even in the darkest of times, when all seems lost, good can come. I want you to apply this last part of the story to your own life and realize it is never too late to balance your life and be a somebody and a nobody and be happy. But first, I want to introduce my sponsor. This episode is brought to you by my sponsor, Podcorn.com. And if you currently have a podcast, or if you are thinking of starting one soon, Podcorn is a name that you will want to remember. Podcorn is a marketplace that connects podcasters to amazing native podcast sponsorship opportunities, such as host read ads, interview segments, topical discussions, and more. With Podcorn, there is no middleman. Podcasters of all sizes can browse and choose opportunities right on their platform, set their own rates, and collaborate with brands directly without any exclusivities. You never give up any rights to your podcast, and Podcorn is here to support you at every step and ensure that you are protected and compensated for the work that you do for brands. Their mission is to give podcasters transparency, creative freedom, and full control of how and when you monetize. As for me, I personally love Podcorn. It allows me to find sponsors that match with my vision of helping to make a positive difference in the lives of others. Each potential sponsor lists a description that mentions about their product or their service, and from that, I can determine if it aligns with my culture. Please go to podcorn.com and sign up. It is free, and it does open a world of financial opportunities for you. Podcorn, it takes the pain out of finding and sponsoring on-demand audio shows, and it empowers podcasters to monetize their voices and their passions in a way that is engaging for listeners. Click the link in my episode description to sign up to Podcorn and start browsing sponsorship opportunities. And with that said, I want to now tell you about the story. A slight noise attracted my notice, and looking to the floor, I saw several enormous rats traversing it. They had issued from the well, which lay just within view of my right. Even then, when I gazed, they came up in troops, hurriedly, with ravenous eyes, allured by the scent of the meat. From this, it required much effort and attention to scare them away. It might have been a half hour, or perhaps even an hour, for I could take but imperfect note of time, before I again cast my eyes upward. What I then saw confounded and amazed me. The sweep of the pendulum had increased in extent by nearly a yard. As a natural consequence, its velocity was also much greater. But what mainly disturbed me was the idea that it had descended. I now observed with what horror it is needless to say that its neither extremity was formed of a crescent of glittering steel, about a foot in length from horn to horn, the horns upward, and the under edge evidently as keen as that of a razor. Like a razor also, it seemed massy and heavy, tapering from the edge into a solid and broad structure above. It was appended to a weighty rod of brass, and the whole hissed as it swung through the air. I could no longer doubt the doom prepared for me by monkish ingenuity in torture. My cognizance of the pit had become known to the inquisitorial agents, the pit whose horrors had been distinct for so bold a recusant as myself, the pit, typical of hell, and regarded by rumor as the ultimate thule of all their punishments. The plunge into this pit I had avoided by the merest of accidents. I knew that surprise, or entrapment into torment, formed an important portion of all the grotesqueness of the dungeon deaths. Having failed to fall, it was no part of the demon plan to hurl me into the abyss, and thus, there being no alternative, a different and a milder destruction awaited me. Milder. I half smiled in my agony as I thought of such application of such a term. What boots it to tell of the long, long hours of horror, more than mortal, during which I counted the rushing vibrations of the steel, inch by inch, line by line, with a descent only appreciable at intervals that seemed ages. Down and still down it came. Days passed. It might have been that many days passed, ere it swept so closely over me as to fan me with its acrid breath. The odor of the sharp steel forced itself into my nostrils, and I prayed. I wearied heaven with my prayer for its more speedy descent. I grew frantically mad, and I struggled to force myself upward against the sweep of the fearful scimitar, and then I fell, suddenly calm, and lay smiling at the glittering death as a child at some rare bauble. There was another interval of utter insensibility. It was brief, for upon again lapsing into life, there had been no perceptible descent in the pendulum. But it might have been long, for I knew that there were demons who took note of my swoon, and who could have arrested the vibration at pleasure. Upon my recovery, too, I felt very, inexpressibly sick and weak. Even amid the agonies of that period, the human nature craved food. With painful effort, I outstretched my left arm as far as my bonds permitted, and took possession of the small remnant which had been spared me by the rats. As I put a portion of it within my lips, there rushed to my mind a half-formed thought of joy, of hope. Yet what business had I with hope? It was, as I say, a half-formed thought. Man has many such which are never completed. I felt that it was of joy, of hope, but felt also that it had perished in its formation. In vain I struggled to perfect and to regain it. Long suffering had nearly annihilated all my ordinary powers of mind. I was an imbecile, an idiot. The vibration of the pendulum was at right angles to my length. I saw that the crescent was designed to cross the region of my heart. It would fray the serge of my robe, and it would return and repeat its operations again and again. Notwithstanding terrifically wide sweep, some 30 feet or more, and the hissing vigor of its descent, sufficient to sunder these very walls of iron, the fraying of my robe would be all that. For several minutes it would accomplish, and at this thought I paused. I dared not go farther than this reflection. I dwelt upon it, as if in so dwelling I could arrest here in the descent of the steel. I forced myself to ponder upon the sound of the crescent as it should pass across the garment, upon the peculiar thrilling sensation which the friction of cloth produces on the nerves. I ponder upon all the frivolity until my teeth were on edge. Down, steadily down I crept. I took a frenzied pleasure in contrasting its downward with its lateral velocity. To the right, to the left, far and wide, with the shriek of a damned spirit, to my heart, with the stealthy pace of a tiger. I alternatively laughed and howled as the one or the other idea grew predominant. Down, certainly relentlessly down, it vibrated within 3 inches of my bosom. I struggled violently, furiously, to free my left arm. This was free only from my elbow to the hand. I could reach the ladder from the platter beside me to my mouth with great effort, but no farther. Could I have broken the fastening above the elbow, I would have seized and attempted to arrest the pendulum. I might as well have attempted to arrest an avalanche. Down, still unceasingly, still inevitably down. I grasped and I struggled at each vibration. I shrunk convulsively at its every sweep. My eyes followed its outward or upward swirls with the eagerness of the most unmeaning despair. They closed themselves spasmodically at the descent, although death would have been a relief. Oh, how unspeakable! Still, I quiver in every nerve to think how slight a sinking of the machinery would precipitate that keen, glistening axe upon my bosom. It was hope that prompted the nerve to quiver, the frame to shrink. It was hope, the hope that triumphs on the rack, that whispers to the death condemned, even in the dungeons of the Inquisition. I saw that 10 or 12 vibrations would bring the steel in actual contact with my robe. And with this observation there suddenly came over my spirit all the keen and collected calmness of despair. For the first time during many hours, or perhaps days, I thought. It now occurred to me that the bandage, or the surcingle, which enveloped me was unique. I was tied by no separate cord. The first stroke of the razor-like crescent athwart any portion of the band would so detach it that it might be unwound from my person by means of my left hand. But how fearful! In that case, the proximity of the steel, the result of the slightest struggle, how deadly! Was it likely, moreover, that the minions of the torture had not foreseen and provided for this possibility? Was it probable that the bandage crossed my bosom in the track of the pendulum? Dreading to find my fate, and as it seemed, in my last hope frustrated, I so far elevated my head as to obtain a distinct view of my breast. The surcingle enveloped my limbs and body closed in all direction, save in the path of the destroying crescent. Scarcely had I dropped my head back into its original position where there flashed upon my mind what I cannot better describe than as a uniform tap of the idea of deliverance to which I had previously alluded, and of which only floated intermittently through my brain when I raised food to my burning lips. The whole thought was now present. Feeble, scarcely sane, scarcely definite, but still entire. I proceeded at once with the nervous energy of despair to attempt its execution. For many hours, the immediate vicinity of the low framework upon which I lay had been literally swarming with rats. They were wild and bold and ravenous, their red eyes glaring upon me as if they waited, but for motionlessness on my part, to make me their prey. To what food, I thought, had they been accustomed in the well? They have devoured, in spite of all my efforts to prevent them, all but a small remnant of the contents of the dish. I had fallen into a habitual seesaw or a wave of the hand about the platter, and at length the unconscious uniformity of the movement deprived it of effect. In their voracity, the vermin frequently fastened their sharp fangs in my fingers. With the particles of the oily and spicy viand which now remained, I thoroughly rubbed the bandage wherever I could reach it, and then raising my hand from the floor, I lay breathlessly still. At first, the ravenous animals were startled and terrified at the change. At the cessation of movement, they shrank alarmingly back. Many sought the well, but this was only for a moment. I had not counted in vain upon their voracity, observing that I remained without motion. One or two of the boldest leaped upon the framework and smelt the surcingle. This seemed the signal for a general rush, and forth from the well they hurried in fresh troops. They clung to the wood, and they overran it and leaped in hundreds upon my person. The measured movement of the pendulum disturbed them not at all. Avoiding its strokes, they busied themselves with the anointed bandage. They pressed and they swarmed upon me in ever-accumulating heaps. They writhed upon my throat. Their cold lips sought my own. I was half-stifled by their thronging pressure. Disgust, for which the world has no name, swelled my bosom and chilled with a heavy clamminess my heart. Yet 1 minute, and I felt that the struggle would be over. Plainly, I perceived the loosening of the bandage. I knew that in more than one place, it must already be severed. With a more than human resolution, I lay still. Nor had I erred in my calculations, nor had I endured in vain. I, at length, felt that I was free. The surcingle hung in ribands from my body, but the stroke of the pendulum already pressed upon my bosom. It had divided the serge of the robe. It had cut through the linen beneath. Twice again it swung, and a sharp sense of pain shot through every nerve. But the moment of escape had arrived. At a wave of my hand, my deliverers hurried tumultuously away. With a steady movement, cautious, sidelong, shrinking and slow, I slid from the embrace of the bandage and beyond the reach of the scimitar. For the moment at least, I was free. Free and in the grasp of the Inquisition. I had scarcely stepped from my wooden bed of horror upon the stone floor of the prison, when the motion of the hellish machine ceased, and I beheld it drawn up by some invisible force through the ceiling. This was a lesson which I took desperately to heart. My every motion was undoubtedly watched. Free, I had but escaped death in one form of agony, to be delivered unto worse than death in some other. With that thought, I rolled my eyes nervously around on the barriers of iron that hemmed me in. Something unusual, some change, which at first I could not appreciate distinctly, it was obvious had taken place in the apartment. For many minutes of a dreamy and trembling abstraction, I busied myself in vain, unconnected conjecture. During this period, I became aware, for the first time, of the origin of the light which illuminated the cell. It proceeded from a fissure about half an inch in width, extending entirely around the prison at the base of the walls, which thus appeared and were completely separated from the floor. I endeavored, but of course in vain, to look through the aperture. As I rose from the attempt, the misery of the alteration in the chamber broke at once upon my understanding. I have observed that although the outlines of the figures upon the walls were sufficiently distinct, yet the colors seemed blurred and indefinite. These colors had now assumed, and were momentarily assuming, a startling and most intense brilliancy. They gave to spectral and fiendish portraitures an aspect that might have thrilled even firmer nerves than my own. Demon eyes of a wild and ghastly vivacity glared upon me in a thousand directions where none had been visible before, and gleamed with the lurid luster of a fire that I could not force my imagination to regard as unreal. Even while I breathed, there came to my nostrils the breath of the vapor of heated iron. A suffocating odor pervaded the prison. A deeper glow settled each moment in my eyes that glared at my agonies. A richer tint of crimson diffused itself over the pictured horrors of blood. I panted. I gasped for breath. There could be no doubt of the design of my tormentors. Oh, most unrelenting, oh, most demonic of men. I shrank from the glowing metal to the center of the cell, amid the thought of the fiery destruction that impended. The idea of the coolness of the well came over my soul like a bomb. I rushed to its deadly brink, and I threw my straining vision below. The glare from the enkindled roof illuminated its innermost recesses. Yet, for a wild moment, did my spirit refuse to comprehend the meaning of what I saw. At length, if forced, it wrestled its way into my soul, and it burned itself upon my shuddering reason. Oh, for a voice to speak! Oh, horror! Oh, horror but this! Oh, any horror but this! With a shriek, I rushed from the margin and buried my face in my hands, weeping bitterly. The heat rapidly increased, and once again I looked up, shuddering as with a fit of the ague. I looked up shuddering. There had been a second chance in the cell, and now the chance was obvious in the form. As before, it was in vain that I, at first, endeavored to appreciate or understood what was taking place. But not long was I left in doubt. The inquisitorial vengeance had been hurried by my twofold escape, and there was to be no more dallying with the king of terrors. The room had been square. I saw the two of its iron angles were now acute, two consequently obtuse. The fearful difference quickly increased with a low rumbling or moaning sound, and in an instant, the apartment had shifted its form, but the alteration stopped not here. I neither hoped nor desired it to stop. I could have clasped the red walls to my bosom as a garment of eternal peace. Death, I said, any death but that of the pit. Fool, might I not have known that into the pit it was the object of the burning iron to urge me? Could I resist its glow? Or even that, could I withstand its pressure? And now, flatter and flatter grew the area with a rapidity that left me no time for contemplation. Its center, of course, its greatest width, came just over the yawning gulf. I shrank back, but the closing walls pressed me resistantly onward. At length, for my seared body, there was no longer an inch of foothold on the firm floor of the prison. I struggled no more, but the agony of my soul found vent in one loud, long, and final scream of despair. I felt that I tottered upon the brink. I averted my eyes. There was a discordant hum of human voices. There was a loud blast as of many trumpets. There was a harsh grating as of a thousand thunders. The fiery walls rushed back, and an outstretched arm caught my own as I fell, fainting into the abyss. It was that of General LaSalle. The French army had entered Toledo. The Inquisition was in the hands of its enemies. Whenever I read the story, The Pen and the Pendulum, it reminds me to never give up. Never give up on hope. Never give up on joy. And never give up on myself. And with that said, my sweet one, good night.